From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 327, recorded live Thursday, July 5th, 2012. This episode is brought to you by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at telerik.com. And by franklins.net, training developers to work smarter. And now offering Gesture Pack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Damian Edwards and Levi Broderick about asynchronous programming.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I've got Damian Edwards on the phone, the quintessential guest, and also we are joined by Levi Broderick, who is probably the smartest guy on the call right now. Sorry, Damian. We're going to talk about async. Thanks for talking to me today, guys.
Not a problem. Thanks for having us.
I think that most people just don't get how to do asynchronous programming in .NET, and I'm going to throw my own name in there as one of the people that just doesn't get it. I think that people think that they have some expensive thing that they want to do, and their initial reaction is that, oh, I'll fire off a background thread. You know, if they're using ASP.NET, they might use queue user work item or something, and they'll fire off a background thread. They'll think it kind of works. They don't really test it because doing that kind of testing is hard. And maybe it'll work, maybe it won't work. If they're really in trouble, they might start poking around inside of machine.config and messing around with the number of threads per CPU that ASP.NET gets. But ultimately, they're not even doing async, are they? Damian?
When it comes to doing async programming on a web server, there's really a very small set of scenarios that make sense to leverage async. And unless you really understand what it means, you're best to kind of avoid it altogether. So one of the things we really want to do over the next year with .NET 4.5 coming out, with this big push around the async programming features in the language and in the framework, is really help people understand when is async programming useful in web application scenarios and how can they leverage the features in ASP.NET to do that.
So I think to myself that there's basically four things that I might want to use async for, but you're saying that maybe people are using it too much. So I'm trying to understand, are we trying to promote this or are we trying to dissuade people from using async?
In my mind, there's really only three concrete scenarios where async makes sense in ASP.NET, in a web application. And only one of those is actually popular. The other two are very, very rare. So the first one is the one that most people associate with it, which is I/O. So this is, and this includes file I/O, network I/O, database I/O, which is generally just network I/O, and then web service calls is the other one, which obviously is network I/O as well. So any time that your server-side ASP.NET code is making a database call or a web service call or a network call or talking to the file system, that can be done asynchronously, such that while that operation is in progress, ASP.NET doesn't have to be consuming a thread, which is a CPU resource, on that box while that operation is taking place. And then once the operation is finished, ASP.NET will do the work to bring that request, sort of rehydrate it, and then continue it on now that you have the result from that call. So that's the first one, and that's the most popular one, and we can drill into these a little bit more as we go on. The second one is the scenario where you actually have, for a given request, you need to retrieve lots of different pieces of information, generally from off-box systems. I had a scenario once where I was building a dashboard type system. The user count was going to be very, very low. Maybe only 5 to 10 users, but this dashboard would have to call out to lots of different APIs to collect information. Some of those APIs were local performance counters, some of them were logs, some of them were databases, and I wanted to show this sort of aggregate of this information on the page. Now, rather than having the request for that page take as long as it would take to call each of those things serially, there may have been 15 or 20 of them, I literally did them all in parallel so that I could get that the page response down to a couple of seconds rather than 20 seconds. And I did so knowing that I was going to actually be consuming more resources, that is more threads, for that request while I was doing that, because a lot of those things that I was calling into didn't have asynchronous APIs. Like calling into performance counters and things like that generally aren't asynchronous. So I actually had to use more threads to get a better response time because the type of page that I was building required information from lots of different places. And I didn't mind doing that because I had a very low user count. I had lots of CPU to spare, and I only had to support a very small number of users at any one time to do it. So the third scenario is long-running event-driven requests. So this is the idea where you have a request that comes in and then the request goes to sleep for some time waiting for some other event to take place. And when that event takes place, you want the request to continue and then send a response to the client. This is really popular when you're trying to do things like HTTP streaming, which is what Signaler does under the covers, where you have a request come in, you want the request to stay open for a long time and only wake up to pump data down to the client when some event has taken place sort of elsewhere. So you want that request to be async for all the times when it isn't doing anything. So they're the three concrete scenarios that I generally identify. And as I said, the first one is really the only really popular one.
Okay. So I chop them up differently. That's actually really a nice way to think about that. I was chopping them up file access, database access, calling out to the network, and then CPU bound thing. So almost a different aspect, a different slice. But yours makes a lot more sense. It does bring up the question, though, that you mentioned asynchronous stuff. You mentioned running things in the background, which is different. And I think people sometimes use those words interchangeably. And then running things in parallel. So there might be an instance where I might want to, in response to a page view on my site, fire off a background thread for a reason, split it into multiple parallel execution paths, and then some of those might do things on asynchronous I/O. Is that correct?
Correct. So you can... asynchrony is kind of is really a relative term. I mean, something can or cannot be async relative to something else. Whereas the idea of parallelism and multi-threaded programming is more concrete. It's like, well, multi-threaded means I'm controlling more than one thread, or a background thread means that I actually kicked off a thread in the background from the thing I kicked it off from, such for it to do some work. And I may care about when it finishes, and I might not. So it might be a fire and forget, or it might be a parallel type of operation. And so, yeah, understanding those terms and interchanging them can sometimes lead to a little bit of confusion. But when we talk about async in ASP.NET, what we generally talk about is the specific support in ASP.NET to have a request handled by the ASP.NET runtime in an asynchronous manner. That is, using one of the asynchronous programming models that .NET actually provides you, such that when ASP.NET gets notification that the request is now in async mode, that there's now nothing more for it to do until something else finishes, that it can free up resources from the request until the async operation is finished.
Levi, could you help me understand that when a request comes into ASP.NET, when I load a page, that is handled by what kind of thread? Is that, that's called a request thread or a user request, or what is that in ASP.NET that is rendering my page and then returning back into a pool?
So in the .NET framework, we have basically two big categories of threads. The first are just regular use respond threads that you can do by calling the system.threading.thread constructor and then saying .start on that. And you as a user, as a developer, are able to just say, do this bit of work, and then this thread is not going to be used for anything else anymore. The thread goes away once the work is finished. The .NET framework also has a thread pool. And the nice thing about thread pools is that they can reuse threads over and over and over again. And threads in Windows are, I don't want to say they're expensive because they're not really expensive, but they're also not cheap because every time a thread is created or torn down, Windows basically has to do a sleight of hand in order to arrange resources for you, in order to make sure that the appropriate data is available to the core that's running that thread. Now, in ASP.NET, whenever we do request processing, we're actually using the CLR thread pool. So if a developer uses threadpool.qUserWorkItem, that's using the same resources that ASP.NET would have used to do regular page processing.
Oh, okay, interesting. So if someone like like, let's just say someone who is not Levi or Damien, I'm not naming names, wants to make, decides to naively make something work faster in ASP.NET, and they start firing off queue user work item, they're really taking threads away. They're starving ASP.NET for, you know, resources it could be using to be doing page work.
Yeah, that's correct. Now, to be fair, the .NET framework is pretty good. At least in .NET 4.5, it's better. But it's pretty good about detecting when there aren't enough threads in the thread pool, and it will start injecting new threads to handle the incoming workload. But in general, though, that point is correct. If you do a thread pool queue user work item, you're taking the same resources that ASP.NET was trying to use to do request processing.
I've worked at a lot of different companies and a lot of different things, and one of the unfortunate things at companies, whether they be banking or whether they be insurance companies, is that everybody thinks that they are a unique snowflake, and they all think that what they're doing is magical and amazing and different from what everyone else is doing, and no matter what, they are smarter than the idiots at Microsoft. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. But the one thing that I find consistently is that when a company reaches a certain size and a certain amount of, in their mind, unique snowflakeness, they immediately start messing around in machine.config and web.config and changing things away from the defaults. And when I talk to Stefan Shacko, who's one of the ASP.NET internals geniuses around the office here, he says there is almost never a reason for you to be messing around with the defaults. Can you help me understand this phenomenon, Levi?
The phenomenon as to why people would want to mess with it?
Well, if we presume that they are, in fact, not unique snowflakes, but they feel that this is a knob or a dial or a switch that they need to mess around with, because obviously the guys at Redmond have made the mistake that whatever number of concurrent requests per CPU is set or number of threads per thread pool is allowed is wrong. And for what they're doing at their fancy company is special. And they'll end up just turning knobs and dials trying to solve a problem. And I think that maybe the problem is that we as an industry just aren't doing this work correctly when it comes to async and background processing.
So I'm not going to let our team get away scot-free on this one, because in earlier versions of ASP.NET, we actually did cap the default number of requests per CPU at a very low number. I think it was maybe 12 requests per CPU. And honestly, with the amount of memory that's in most servers, I mean, we're talking, you know, 8, 12, 24 gigabytes of RAM. You can certainly do more than 12 requests per CPU, even if all of those threads are blocking, waiting for some event to take place. I think that might be the reason that a lot of people like messing with these switches, just because there's still this misconception that ASP.NET still does not scale well, where in 4.0 especially, we've made great strides so that that's no longer the case.
Nice. Do you know what those values are now, guys?
Yeah,
so I think it's at least 100 per thread, or per core, I thought.
It's a 5,000 concurrent requests per CPU in ASP.NET 4 by default. We've had to fiddle with these a lot when doing signalR testing, which is why I've got some recent experience with it. But ASP.NET isn't the only thing in the pipeline that you have to be aware of course. I mean, IIS is sitting in front of ASP.NET, and it has its own queuing and sort of throttling mechanisms that you have to be aware of. So by default, the app pool, there's some settings on the app pool, one of which is the queue depth for the HTTP sys, and that is defaults to it's 1,000 or 5,000, I can't remember. It's much smaller than the default ASP.NET settings if you have more than one CPU. So if you're trying to tune for concurrency, that is, you want to tune such that your web server can deal with lots and lots of simultaneously running web requests at the same time, then you sometimes need to go and adjust these settings, because in a very, very high load web server, you can get beyond 5,000 current requests per CPU or 5,000 current requests for the entire box. But generally, that's a lot of load you need to be getting before you hit that sort of thing. The reason we have to do it in SignalR is because most of our requests never go away. We create a request and then it stays open forever while we pump data over it. So we have to tune the server to do long-running concurrent requests versus lots and lots of very short running requests for high throughput.
So I've been doing ASP.NET for a long time and .NET since the day it came out. That's almost 10 years now. And a couple of days ago, I was working on a pan tilt zoom thing that I'm working on to get a camera working. And I ended up finding an old library. So I'm in .NET 4.5 doing some work, and I pull in this .NET 1.1 library. And I find myself doing begin start pan and end start pan. And it took me a while to get my brain back on top of this. And then I pulled in another library, and it had something something async and something something async completed. But my brain is starting to get more tuned to the way that the tasks and background tasks and things like that are working. What's going on there? Why am I in one project thinking about three different kinds of asynchronous programming? And does one encapsulate the other? Is it like a series of onion layers where one lays on top of the next, Damien?
No, unfortunately. In some cases, yes. But mostly no. So let us go through the sorted history of asynchronous programming in .NET, and we will hopefully clarify what all these different things mean. Unfortunately, there is some overlap. So in .NET 1/1.1 world, we had what was called APM, the asynchronous programming model. And this is the begin/end method pairs that you talked about. So if you had some type of operation that, when called, could be done asynchronously, meaning that you could immediately return to the application, give them some token that represents whether that operation has finished or not, and then also have the caller pass in a delegate the other side will call back when the async operation is finished, then you would expose that operation with two methods. One would be a begin method that returned an iasync result. That's iasync result. It's an interface in the .NET base class library. And then there would be an end pair to that method, which would return either void if it was the type of async method that didn't return anything, or it would return some object if you were perhaps looking up something from a database, for instance, maybe a data reader or something like that.
Okay. So that's a model that's used for any kind of asynchronous programming. Like I was talking to hardware, or you could be talking to a database. It's just do something, begin, then there's a callback, and then you say end in the middle of that callback.
So yeah, when you pass in a callback, and then the other side will call that callback when it's finished, and then the callback that you passed in, inside the body of that callback, you'll call the end method, passing in the original iasync result that the begin method returned. Because the iasync result is kind of the token that represents that asynchronous operation. And then once you call end, the other side will give you back the result if there was a result to be handed back. It's an easy programming sort of paradigm to understand if you're doing one asynchronous operation. You can kind of get your head around that fairly easily. Where I always had trouble with APM was when I had to do any type of asynchronous composition, where I wanted to say, do this asynchronous task, and then when that's finished, do this asynchronous task, then fire off these two in parallel asynchronously, and then when the whole thing finishes, continue on to do something else. That type of programming with APM was really difficult because the primitives didn't exist in .NET to help you do that composition. You had to write your own custom iasync result implementations, or you had to chain your own custom callback delegates in order to say, when this is finished, do that, then kick this off, and then do that. So that led to what we had in .NET 2, which is what we called evented asynchronous, or EAP, the evented asynchronous pattern. So EAP were those letters again. And that's where we start to see these new method pairs, or a method plus an event. So you alluded to it. You said you saw something like foo async and then foo completed event. Mm-hmm. And the idea of this was that you would call foo async after you had subscribed an event handler to the foo completed event. Now, it doesn't actually sound all that different if you think about it. All they're really doing is hiding the iasync result from you, and rather than you providing a callback, you've attached the callback to an event that will get raised by the object that you fire this async method on. Now, the big difference, though, is that the evented async programming model utilizes something under the covers called a synchronization context, so that it's really good for things like UI frameworks where you have this idea of a UI thread, this main thread that the application is running on, and then you want to do asynchronous work in the background, and when that's finished, you need to marshal that result back onto the correct thread before you can update your UI. The event async pattern kind of did this for you under the covers. We had objects like the background worker class, which a lot of people would have used in WinForms, where you sort of gave it a delegate to run in the background and it would go off and fire a new thread. And it would fire events back on the UI thread telling you when there was progress and when the thing had finished. So you didn't have to worry about this whole marshalling of data from one thread to another. So that's APM and EAP. And then in .NET 4, they introduced the task asynchronous pattern, or TAP. Some people will know this as TPL, the task parallel library. And this is where we saw a new set of types, a new set of primitives introduced in the framework that enabled us to get a handle on an asynchronous operation, a bit like iasync result, except this time it's called task. And the task represents a promise. It represents the fact that something is running. It's either finished already or it might finish in the future. But rather than just being a token that I then am able to pass into some other method to get the result, the task itself includes other methods that I can use to do composition. So I can say, here is a task that represents this async operation. When that's finished, .continue with, go off and do this other bunch of work. And getting passed into the delegate that you pass in there is the previous task that finished. So if it had a result, you can just grab it off that task. So TAP introduced much nicer composition models for asynchronous programming while still utilizing the synchronization context. If necessary, if you want to, you can do that underneath the covers to do synchronization between different threads and different contexts.
The async and await keywords, Levi, how did those make that better for, I mean, like TAP sounds really, really straightforward, but people didn't necessarily flood to in that direction and like start using this. And clearly Anders and the powers that be felt the need to go and do async and await keywords. That added what to the mix here?
So remember how Damien was talking about composition, the fact that when a task is finished, you can provide it a piece of work to continue with, a continuation routine. Most programmers in C# and VB, because C# and VB are imperative languages as opposed to a functional language, they don't really think in terms of continuations. It's very odd for a programmer who's used to these languages to have to kind of divide his program up into a series of callbacks. And a series of callbacks is unfortunately what the task parallel library takes as a parameter. Now, the async and await keywords make this a lot easier because they'll automatically turn your method that is marked using the async and await keywords into a giant state machine that can provide its own series of callbacks. It's very similar to what the yield keyword does in C#. So if you imagine that you write a regular synchronous program, and all of a sudden you want to start calling a method that ends in async, it returns a task. If you prefix that call with the await keyword, the compiler will actually split that method into two. The first part of the method, the first method, will be everything that is before the call to the task returning method. The second method will be everything that is after the call to the task returning method. And the compiler will automatically turn that second half of your code into a callback and pass it into the task routines. So you get all of the benefits of using the task async pattern, but you get the nice language syntax of making your program look as if it were written synchronously. You as a developer don't have to worry about splitting your application up like this. The compiler does it on your behalf.
Interesting. You know, this might be my ignorance showing, but this makes me think about 10 years ago when we all learned about iDisposable and try catch finally and things like that. And you would go and you'd make something, you would do a try catch finally, and then you dispose it, and then someone came out with using, and you would say, using this particular variable, and then you'd have a scope block and you'd do your thing. And then we would all rush over into IL-DASM or Reflector and we'd say, look, you said using, and they put a try-catch finally, and see in the finally, they put a dispose automatically for you. And we just thought that was amazing. That was the greatest thing. This is another example of that comparatively small or apparently small syntactic sugar that really turns into an astonishingly useful pattern under the wire, all done by the covers, all done by the compiler.
Oh yeah, certainly. And if you go take a look at a program that's using async await and open it up in Reflector, IL-Spy, or IL-DASM or something, your mind will be blown by the IL that's generated.
You should sit down before you look at that.
Yes, please.
Maybe it's best that we not look at that. Yeah. Actually, although speaking of things that we should look at, Rick Anderson, one of the technical writers and a really talented guy on our team, has got this amazing article that everyone's got to read, and it's a crime that there's not more comments on this article, where he talks about doing asynchronous methods in ASP.NET 4, and he points out a couple of things in here. First, he's got some really great examples where he's using web forms to do async, which I think all makes the point that really, really smart people do web forms too. Smart people don't necessarily need to go over to MVC to get a really productive environment. But he's got this bit of code here where he says he's going to call into three web services. So the page load does some stuff, and then it fires off into three web services, and it does those asynchronously. And he says, await task when all, and then he passes in the three tasks. If I understand correctly, is that literally saying, hang out here until all three of these are done, Damien?
It is saying that, but rather than saying, hang out here and consume a thread, it's saying, make this request sort of spin down for now, and then when all these things come back, spin the request up again, grab a new thread, and continue execution. So that's what we call an async wait versus a blocking wait.
That is something that would be amazingly difficult and frustrating a couple of years back. Speaking to what Levi was talking about chaining things together, when I was doing this asynchronous work and background work on this little camera, I think I got four or five deep, and it was like you'd call something, and then you'd wait for the callback, and then in that callback, you'd go and fire something else off, and then wait for that callback. And I ended up with, five, six, seven different methods. It became really, really difficult to get my head around this and what was happening. And I kept going back and forth. Do I want to do this as one giant function with 20 curly braces and nest them? Or do I want to make a bunch of little tiny functions to do something very simple?
Yeah. And when I see code like that, I think I actually had a look at the code that you were writing. I again get into those. I'm the same as you. I go, well, shall I do this like I would do JavaScript and just have a whole bunch of nested callbacks? Should I split them out like VS sort of leads me to do by using plus equals, creating extra delegates that I then call? Or maybe I should do a little bit more work and create my own wrapper around this entire mess and create sort of a mini Fluent API for doing this, so I can say, do this, and then that returns something that I can then do something else on, and then that returns something that I can then do something else on. Mm-hmm. And while that may sound like a lot of work, if all you're trying to do is clean up the code of a specifically complex series of operations where you're trying to do six or seven or more things that are asynchronous, I think sometimes it's worth the work because it really will generally only take you a very short amount of time, and your code will be that much easier to read in terms when scanning through and trying to understand what this block of 40 lines is doing. It'll be much clearer to you later on.
Levi, kind of in conclusion, why do you think that all of this is happening now? Why did it take this long for async to come to .NET? Is this something if I go and look at Lisp, are they already doing this? Did they do this like awesome 40 years ago and we're just now catching up? Or is there a particular reason you think that frameworks are moving towards async today?
So if you look at the .NET framework in particular, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that since .NET is supposed to be one of the ways of writing good Windows 8 applications in particular, they wanted people to use asynchronous methods precisely because they use fewer resources, less CPU time, and it's honestly better on the battery for mobile devices. But that's just talking about the client side. On the server side, you really have issues of scale. We have all of these cloud services now where you're expected to be able to handle hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of simultaneous users. And when I say simultaneous, I mean, you know, there are that many connections actually active to the server at once. And it's just not practical to have 10,000 threads running in the IIS process, each thread's taking up a 250 kilobyte stack. I mean, you're going to start using gigabytes of memory just to handle threading at that point. And as far as scale goes, that's just a non-starter.
Damien, do you have anything that you want to add in conclusion?
Just that, you know, ASP.NET has had support for this asynchronous stuff pretty much since the very beginning. But I think the most work we've done on this is in the latest release in 4.5. And Levi did an awful lot of work to ensure that the async model in ASP.NET works really, really well with the new async await language support that we've introduced in .NET 4.5 as well. So if you haven't looked at it yet, it doesn't matter if you're a web forms programmer, an MVC programmer, or even coding raw HTTP handlers and HTTP modules, I think you'll find that using the async abilities in ASP.NET today, you should be able to, it's a much happier place to be than it was a couple of years ago, put it that way.
Cool. Well, you guys are going to give me links that we'll put in the show notes for articles and MSDN things and tutorials that we think that people should check out. And maybe even a couple, if you think about it, a couple of ideas of open source projects that would be advanced examples of this, and SignalR is the first one that comes to mind, to really see what tuned and continually tuned asynchronous work in ASP.NET looks like. They should check out the SignalR library.
Sure.
All right, this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you again next week.